Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Finance historian Neil Ferguson has studied the collapse of empires and imagined how they might have survived. The end, he says, tends to come suddenly for Rome, China's Ming, the British, the Soviet Union, and it's often precipitated by fiscal crisis. He warns that America, with its ballooning trillions of dollars of debt, may be in the red zone. His critics say he may help push it there. This hour on Point, Neil Ferguson's big take on where America stands now and how to avoid a fall. You can join the conversation. Do you see the U.S. bouncing back, going down, holding steady? What's the right medicine now? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Neil Ferguson, professor of history and business administration at Harvard University. He's the best-selling author of Empire, Colossus, and The Ascent of Money, A Financial History of the World. His new book, out this week, is High Financier, The Lives and Time of Sigmund Warburg. Neil Ferguson, welcome back to On Point.
Nice to be back, Tom.
It's great to have you with us. You always put things in very, very, very big terms, rise and fall of empire and all the rest. And here you are in the middle of this furious debate, and absolutely up to the second, over whether we should be spending more stimulus money to keep the economy from long-term deep damage, or whether we should be slamming on the brakes. How can it be that smart people can have such divergent views on this point, Neil?
Well, I think the answer to that, Tom, is that we're in an unprecedented situation. There haven't been that many Great Depressions in history, maximum three, if you include the 1873 Depression, the Great Depression, and the one we're in. And only in one of these, our own Depression or Great Recession, have we attempted massive fiscal and monetary stimulus as a solution to the problem. And so nobody really can be quite sure what the consequences will be. Now, short term, and I want to make this very clear, short term, it was the right thing to run large deficits, and it was the right thing for the Fed massively to expand its balance sheet to inject liquidity into the banking system. The question is really about the medium to long term, because right now the U.S. is on course to run a deficit every year for the rest of time, and these are pretty big deficits of the order of 10% of GDP. It comes down a little bit in the official projections for a few years, and then it goes right back up. Now, that's not Keynesianism as John Maynard Keynes intended it. The Keynesian view was that for a short period in a depression, you needed that kind of stimulus. It was not intended to become a permanent feature. And the argument that I've been making now for over a year is that if you set yourself up on course to run a deficit every year for the rest of time, at some point in the not too far distant future, this starts to have unintended negative consequences. And that's really the essence of the debate between me and others like, for example, Paul Krugman. Just how long before this thing starts to backfire?
When you get into this debate, it automatically puts it in these giant terms because you've written so much about empire, colossus, rise, fall, and all the rest that it seems to put, you know, the whole kitty on the table, the whole American era on the table and threaten its collapse. And you have written very recently, when collapses come, they tend to come quickly. But who's to say, Neil, what exactly defines short term here? I mean, Paul Krugman, we tried to get him on, he's traveling, but he said penny pinching at a time like this, he just wrote in the last couple of days, isn't just cruel, it endangers the nation's future, does long-term damage. He says, spend now, save later. What do you say?
It all depends what you mean by later. Right now, as I've said, there is absolutely no plan on any time horizon for a return to fiscal stability. If you look at the Congressional Budget Office projections right out to the year 2083, if memory serves, there's never a balanced budget for the federal government.
He acknowledges that, says let's do it, but let's do it later.
But this is the critical point. Mm-hmm. If you adopt this policy of fiscal stimulus every year, at some point your debt exceeds your gross domestic product. In other words, you end up with a debt to GDP ratio of 100% or more. Now, we're on course to be there if you measure it by gross debt pretty soon. And even if you measure it by net debt, you get there in, a 10-year time frame. Now, we have very good empirical evidence, not least from the work of my Harvard colleague, Ken Rogoff, mm-hmm. that once a government gets up to a debt-GDP ratio north of 90%, there start to be these negative consequences. And let me explain what they are. What happens is that the people lending to the US federal government, which, remember, includes a lot of foreign governments, including the Chinese, start to say, you know what, that 3.2 or 3.5% return that you're promising mm-hmm. us, if we lend you money for 10 years by buying 10-year treasuries, isn't enough to compensate us for the risk that you guys may inflate your currency or may even default on this debt. We've looked at other countries, including Greece and Portugal and Spain, that have got into similar fiscal problems, and we would like some compensation in the form of higher interest rates, higher yields in the bonds. Now, if you find yourself paying not 3.5, but 4.5 or 5.5, or in the case of a country like Greece, suddenly closer to 9%, you get into this death spiral where the cost of servicing your existing debt starts to consume a larger and larger share of all your tax revenues. Your credibility goes, and you begin to go into a tailspin in which your borrowing costs rise, and as they rise, you end up having to borrow more money just to pay the interest on the debt you previously had. The danger is that at some point, the credibility of US fiscal policy is called into question, just as that of Greece was called into question earlier this year, and then you are in the kind of dramatic crisis that I'm talking about, when suddenly not only your economic policy, but your whole strategy as a great power is called into question.
Is that the quick collapse scenario you've been writing about recently? Do you really think that right now the United States has it all on the line in this question?
Well, yes, I do. And I think there's a lot of historical evidence to support this point. One point that I tried to make in a recent article in Foreign Affairs was that when you look at countries whose debt service costs, that is to say the interest payments on their national debt, start to go up above 25% or 30% of all their tax revenues, or, for example, start absorbing more tax revenue than their military expenditure, then generally speaking, that sets alarm bells ringing, and it usually is a kind of harbinger of major crisis ahead. That was the case for example, 18th century France. It was also the case for Britain after World War II. And the US is on course to have that kind of a debt problem within a 5 to 10 year time frame, depending on what happens to interest rates. And that's really, I think, that the point that differentiates me from someone like Paul Krugman, who, as an economist and a Keynesian, is focused on essentially this year's gross domestic product number and wants to see GDP growth that is strongly positive in order to get us out of a recession. It seems to me that the risk of that strategy is that at some point its costs begin to outweigh its benefits. And that's really the scenario that I'm trying to argue for, not as an economist so much as an historian.
This is the kind of stupefying scenario where you've got somebody like you and then somebody like Krugman, each warning that the other is putting the country on course for a kind of death spiral. It's kind of mind-blowing. You write at the end of that big essay in Foreign Affairs, empires behave like all complex adaptive systems. They function in apparent equilibrium for some unknowable period, and then quite abruptly, they collapse. If you're saying that's the risk right here, right now with the United States, what does that mean? What is a collapse of, or what would a collapse of this center of global influence mean for Americans, mean for the world?
Well, let me just make two quick points of clarification. Mm-hmm. This might not happen this year. I don't think it'll happen.
Great, good.
Because right now the focus is all on Europe and the credibility of fiscal policy in Europe. And European governments are scrambling to try to stabilize their public finances to avoid the scenario that I've been describing.
Though Krugman says that they're putting themselves on a kind of a Weimar collapse path by that. So even there, we've got the same argument.
That's pretty unpersuasive, and I think I probably know more about the Weimar case than he does since I wrote my PhD on it. Mm. What caused Weimar was excessive deficits, which were ultimately financed by printing money.
Inflation.
And I think the critical second point I'd make is that there are two ways of dealing with this sort of fiscal deficit. You can raise taxes and cut public services in such a way as to depress economic behavior. That's really what Krugman says will happen, that whatever you do to reduce the deficit will have a negative impact on growth and therefore make the situation worse. Now, the argument that I would make is that, yes, there are some cases in which you would make things worse, and it's very, very dangerous in that sense to go down the route of raising taxes. But there are other ways in which you can actually increase economic growth by creating confidence, particularly business confidence. So it all depends on how you go about reducing the deficit. As we're speaking, the UK is unveiling a new budget which will involve significant tax hikes but also significant cuts in public services. I would like to be able to say that it will work and that it will produce a kind of growth bounce that will get the new Conservative Liberal government out of jail. But I'm not convinced, because it looks to me as if they've really done too much tax raising and not enough to stimulate business confidence. There's some really fascinating work by an economist we don't hear enough from these days, Tom Sargent at NYU, which shows that if you do things that are sort of radical enough, if you attack welfare entitlements, if you reduce, say, corporation tax, if you increase taxes and consumption, get the mix right, and put government finance onto a path in the direction of stability, you can end up stimulating growth. So I would say there are two ways in which this can play out. You can tighten fiscal policy and shoot yourself in the foot. Let's call that the Krugman scenario. Or you can tighten it in such a way that you actually stimulate economic growth and reduce the worries that people have. If you look at recent opinion surveys,
hold it right there. If you would be good enough, Professor Ferguson, we've got to take a short break here. We've got a lot on the table. We'll come straight back to it. Neil Ferguson is with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour with historian, finance historian Neil Ferguson, chronicler of fallen empires, about America and the U.S. economy now and how to avoid the big fall. His latest book is on Sigmund Warburg, called High Financier, The Lives and Times of Sigmund Warburg. We'll talk a little bit about that. There's a lot on the table already. Neil Ferguson joins us from New York, and we've got a lot of questions from listeners, Neil. Mike in Beaufort, North Carolina. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi. So just one or two quick comments. First of all, his comment regarding knowing more about the Weimar than Paul Krugman, well, I would take a difference with someone writing a PhD thesis versus a Nobel Prize winner's comment.
It's a clash of titans. We'll get due respect to all.
Okay. The other point is, I certainly agree that we can't get into a death spiral on debt. However, the whole issue is, and the whole issue is how you do it. And there's a lot of ways to balance this equation on either side. And it's interesting to me that your guest
Neil
is
Ferguson
saying raise taxes or on the one side, or don't raise taxes because the alternative is raising business confidence. Well, guess what? That both deals with the highest issue right now is the highest income inequality we've had in our history, economic history. And I would beg to say that maybe an alternative is to worry about the income inequality right now and solve it in a way that solves the debt but deals more equally than just worrying about raising business confidence at a time that they're getting the greatest income inequality we've ever had.
Mike, you put it very well, and I'm glad you raised just that. I mean, Neil, I can imagine many people listening to your formula and thinking, you know, it sounds a little bit like saying that the small people need to bite the bullet, take the pain, let business go on a romp, cut corporate taxes, everything will be fine. But you hear Mike's demur.
Well, from the point of view of so-called small people, the key thing is employment. And it's far preferable to be in employment than to be on welfare, clearly. The critical issue here is how jobs get created in an economy. And one fairly obvious lesson is that it's best done by business rather than by government. And indeed, what's striking is that it tends to be small business that creates the jobs. And right now, the problem we have is that although we threw $700 billion of stimulus at the economy, it really didn't have an impact on business formation and on small business hiring. So that's one reason why one has to be a bit skeptical of the Keynesian recipe for yet more deficit finance. It didn't really deliver to that engine of growth that is so crucial for employment. And I think that's the right way of thinking about this. If you just start with income distribution and say, you know what, in the midst of this great recession, we should also focus on redistribution, so let's whack the taxes up on high earners, that can really end up being a very counterproductive strategy. One of the reasons that I got interested in Sigmund Warburg's life is that it covered a period, he died in 1982, when we actually tried this before. Keynesianism was the orthodoxy for economic policymakers in the 1960s and 1970s. The British government, which was very much in a post-imperial crisis, again and again used deficits in an attempt to maintain employment levels. It expanded public sector employment, and the result, of course, was stagflation. By the 1970s, Britain was in such a mess that it had 27% inflation and had to call in the IMF to bail the government out. So I think there's a very substantial body of historical evidence that suggests that Keynesianism can end up being the disease of which it pretends to be the cure.
But still, it may sound as though, I mean, there you are, you know, best-selling author, great positions, you, and Krugman for that matter too, but, you know, this can sound like a kind of pull the ladder up into the ivory tower, let the little people struggle for 10 years, we'll save the empire and all will party on. Is it a fair division of pain to save, you know, the ship of state when the little people just bailed out these big corporations?
Well, nobody has been more critical than I have been of the bailing out of too big to fail institutions that richly deserved to fail. And I've been one of those who have consistently warned against the situation in which we use taxpayers' money to bail out institutions that were highly profitable for the people running them and the people who owned the shares. So I think this is a separate issue. We can certainly get into that issue. But the critical point, once again, for those people at the lower end of the income distribution is that it is better, much better, to be employed than to be on welfare. And what we need is a combination of policies that will encourage people to hire. And that means encouraging businesses, and not big businesses. I'm not talking here about Goldman Sachs or J.P. Morgan. I'm talking here about the small businesses all over the United States that are typically run, you know, by people who are relatively well off, but not mega rich. I mean, these are not people with private jets, but they are the engine of the economy. And we mustn't lose sight of the fact that the United States creates jobs when small businessmen are confident and feel like hiring. Right now, they are not. And I think there are two reasons for that. One, they see coming towards them higher taxes, because that is a clear implication of the fiscal policy we're pursuing right now. And they also find it pretty hard to get bank loans. One of the ironies of the situation that we're now in is that although we've thrown a ton of money at the financial system, credit is contracting, and so is the money supply. So there are considerable reasons for anxiety about not only fiscal policy, but also monetary policy right now. If what you want is to get ordinary Americans into work, then I think it's highly questionable that the current strategy is working, and it's even more questionable that additional doses of stimulus would make things better.
What do you make of Krugman's complaint that those in Congress, in the U.S. Congress, who are speaking out loud, most loudly about the deficit, are also tend to be those who are fighting to cut estate taxes on the wealthy in this country? Are those contradictory?
Well, I think it's very important to acknowledge that sometimes Paul Krugman and I agree, and we have in fact been in agreement over the years in criticizing congressional Republicans for their double standards on fiscal policy. For many years, the Republican Party convinced itself that deficits didn't matter, and that all they had to do was cut taxes, particularly on high earners, to achieve sustained economic growth. This was a great illusion. And in the early 2000s, for example, in my book Colossus, The Rise and Fall of the American Empire, which was published in 2004, I inveighed against this Republican mindset and argued that the U.S. was on course for a major crisis of public debt. Well, we're now in that crisis. It's a Democratic administration that's in office, but we shouldn't pretend that this problem started when Barack Obama was elected president. This problem goes right back to the year 2001.
Or much further than that. I mean, if you look at when U.S. debt, you know, the ratio of debt to GDP just exploded. started, it was in the 1980s, and it was in the George W. Bush years.
What's interesting about the Reagan era is that although there was a spike in the debt in the 80s, it came down afterwards, and it didn't go up to critical levels. And indeed, the economy grew strongly, which is obviously the most important thing. I think Ronald Reagan should be given a pretty good grade for fiscal policy, because one of the consequences of that that fiscal expansion in the 80s was that the U.S. won the Cold War, and the payoffs were very obvious in the 1990s under Bill Clinton. The payoffs in the sense that the U.S. economy was in a higher growth path after the 1980s, and it was also in a much more secure strategic position, so it was able to spend a lot less on defense. That was the peace dividend. So we got back into a position of great fiscal health in the 1990s, and from 2001 onwards, I'm afraid we came off the rails so dramatically that by 2004, I argued in a piece that made me hugely unpopular on the right, entitled Republicans for Kerry, that it would be better to end the Bush administration after one term than continue with this reckless fiscal policy. Now, the deficits of the Bush years look pretty small by comparison with the ones that we're in now, but I think it's very important to recognize the extent to which the seeds of the financial crisis were sown in the early 2000s, and a lot of the responsibility for that must lie with the Republican leadership in Congress.
Historian Neil Ferguson is with us. His new book is High Financier. Alan is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Alan, you're on the air.
Great show, Tom, and really enjoy this. Well, we have a situation here where we are in a death spiral nationally, but we're also in a personal death spiral. About a quarter of the country is upside down in their mortgages and getting hammered with interest charges and credit cards, bank fees, and all this. And a great majority of these people are taxpayers within the middle-income tax brackets, and these are the people that we're supposed to go after and tax more. We have a massive explosion of entitlement that has caused this giant deficit, and is Congress as well is responsible, Democrats and Republicans. Until these entitlements are ramped back severely, like England is doing, we're going to go down the tubes. You can't just keep handing out money and taxing. You can tax everybody into the Stone Age and take all their money, and the bureaucrats would find a way to spend it all and run deficits again.
But, Alan, a lot of those entitlements go to the middle class. I think I hear you standing up for.
Well, not exactly, because if we've got to cut back on everything, all the tax-paying people, what about everybody else cut back, too? Everybody's getting all the free checks and entitlements. You can't do this. You just can't keep raising taxes.
But, you know, Medicare is an entitlement. Social Security is an entitlement. You seem to be saying welfare, but, of course, it's much broader than just the impoverished.
Medicare and Social Security, we knew this was happening 15 years ago, that this debt bomb was going to happen with entitlements. This wasn't new news. This was known a long time ago under Bush and Clinton and Reagan. Everybody predicted in the year 2010, 2012, entitlement explosion was going to kill us with Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security.
Neil Ferguson, in your view, who needs to or who should or who will take the pain?
Well, I agree with the point that Alan's making, that this is a problem that's been a long time coming. Politicians have pretended it wasn't coming because it was too politically difficult to talk about it. But the unfunded liabilities of Medicare and Social Security dwarf the stated debt of the federal government. And they really are the problem if you take a longer-term time horizon, look out 10 or 20 years. Now, as you rightly said, Tom, these are entitlements that go to everybody over a certain age, in effect. And I think that's why sometimes talking about this in terms of class isn't that illuminating, because it's really about intergenerational transfers. Once the baby boomers started retiring, which they now have started retiring, the transfers that are required from people in employment to retirees explode. And that's really the biggest structural problem of U.S. public finance right now. The only way to address this must be either a switch to means testing, which means that these entitlements only go to lower income groups, or a significant scaling back of the amount that is paid and a shift in the age at which it's paid. In other words, we need to start talking about retiring later. That's something that most European governments have been discussing for a considerable time now, and it's where we're going to get to. The only question in my mind is whether we get to a radical reform of entitlements before the crisis strikes, or whether we have to wait for the crisis in order to force political action. And I'm always reminded of Winston Churchill's great line about the United States, that the US always does the right thing when all the alternatives have been exhausted. And it seems to me we're kind of in that position now. We're essentially hoping that we'll be fine as long as everybody else is worse off, as long as the Europeans are in a debt crisis. People will lend us money at a reasonably low rate, so why not carry on borrowing? Well, you can do that, but at some point there will be a fiscal crisis. It will catch up with us. And then, of course, it's much, much harder to solve the problem. It would be better to act now. It would have been better to act 15 years ago, as your listener just said. But the longer we put this off, the bigger the problem becomes.
Okay, here's Henry Blodgett, and he's looking at the Krugman-Ferguson dust-up, and he's got big questions for both of you. He looks at you and the Tea Party in the same nutshell, Neil, and here's his question. And it's much like Krugman's question for you, but he says, if we cut spending now, what's going to happen to the economy and unemployment in the short term? Will it actually exacerbate the debt and deficit problem by reducing tax receipts and leave us in a worse hole? Krugman says a hole that could do us more damage. He says, wait, Neil.
Well, first of all, let me put this in terms not just of today, but let's say the next 5 to 10 years. What we don't have at the moment is a credible plan to get the United States back into fiscal equilibrium. What we have at the moment is the prospect of trillion-dollar deficits for the rest of time. So number one, it may not be fiscal tightening today that we need, but we need to have a path, a credible path, back to stability over a 5 to 10 year time frame. Secondly, I think we need to be looking a lot harder at some of the more radical proposals for fiscal reform that are out there. Paul Ryan is one of the few young Republicans in Congress thinking seriously about what we can do to address the entitlements problem and also the tax problem in such a way that we get the U.S. into higher growth, and that's the key. What's interesting is that Ryan's plan, which was costed by the Congressional Budget Office, seems to deliver. Now, it involves some pretty radical changes. In effect, it ends Social Security for the for younger generations. They end up in a very different plan. It scales back Medicare significantly. It simplifies the income tax code. It reduces corporate tax. It creates a federal sales tax. It's a very radical plan. But I think it's very significant that the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, gave it a good, indeed a clean bill of health, and it solves the fiscal crisis. What's depressing to me is how few Republicans, to say nothing of Democrats, are willing to talk seriously in this kind of way. Without radical reform, I think we get into trouble whether we pursue a Krugman line or not. Whether we don't cut or do cut, we end up in a hole at some point in the next few years.
Okay, let's look at a response then. It may not be on the table, but people are talking about getting it on the table. I'm looking here at Edmund Andrews, New York Times, and he's blogging about this whole deal. He was looking at Greenspan in particular, who's also being read as saying, slam the brakes on spending. And he says, you know, he's flat wrong about that, but he acknowledges, as you warn, Neil Ferguson, that there is a non-trivial risk, of his words, of a bond market rebellion. But here's his solution. He said, go ahead with another round of stimulus spending now so we don't fall in a big hole, but then call for real belt tightening around 2015. This is Edmund Andrews. 2015, limit future entitlements, limit our military ambition, rein in health care costs, increase tax revenues, put all those plans on the table, but also put a date on it. We'll start that in 2015.
Well, that's very close to what I argued over a year ago in the debate that I had with Paul Krugman, that a credible plan to get us back into a stable position would, in fact, boost growth now because it would restore business confidence, which is clearly lacking.
But how about the stimulus piece? Would you allow for that if there was a credible plan on the table for then cutting back?
The kind of stimulus that we could have right now that would attract me hugely would involve simplification of the tax code and reduction of corporate taxation to encourage business to expand and create jobs. I would not like to see yet more expenditure by federal or state government, yet more expansion of public payrolls, yet more expenditures on welfare.
Why do you need more than 0% interest rates to encourage business development? Isn't that enough? I mean, that's pretty incredible.
Let's be very clear that those low rates aren't available to everybody. I don't know whether you were able to get a 0% loan anytime
in
the last few weeks.
No.
Me neither. It's all very well if you're able to go to the Fed discount window as J.P. Morgan and say, yeah, please, can I have free money? But most small businesses are nowhere close. In fact, most small businesses will tell you that it's getting harder and harder to roll over their short-term borrowings. I hear this complaint all the time from people all across the country who feel that there really is a double standard in the credit system. If you're one of the too big to fail institutions, you get the free money. If you're a small business out there in Texas, then it's not available to you. So we, you know, we do need to bear in mind that that's one of the things that is going wrong right now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with historian, finance historian Neil Ferguson, chronicler of fallen empires, about America and the U.S. economy now and how to avoid the big fall. His new book is High Financier, The Lives and Time of Sigmund Warburg. Neil Ferguson joins us from New York. President Obama was in Columbus, Ohio on Friday, talking before a backdrop of a lot of construction vehicles and workers there at the site of the 10,000th road project funded by the Recovery Act. The president said the economy is perking up.
Since I was here last year, we've begun to see progress all across the country. Businesses are beginning to hire again. Our economy, which was shrinking by 6% when I was sworn in, is now growing at a good clip. And we've added jobs for 6 out of the past 7 months in this country. We were losing 700,000 jobs a month. For the last 6 out of the last 7 months, we've increased jobs here in the United States of America, in part because of the policies that these members of Congress were willing to step up and implement.
Okay, says historian Neil Ferguson, but this American era could still collapse. Lots of callers here. Angelo, Hamden, Connecticut, you're on the air with Neil Ferguson.
Hi, Tom. I just want to say that, you know, this is really unfair. The reality is that without the Obama stimulus package, the recession that we're in now would have been far worse. The stimulus package was very important and was very effective in avoiding a far more serious economic collapse. Number two, the reason the banks aren't lending to small businesses is because the banks are in a hurry to pay back the government for the bailout money that they were given. So instead of lending to small businesses, they're just paying the government back. They don't want to lend to small businesses because it's a risky endeavor. They don't know if these small businesses are going to survive or fail. The other issue that comes up with the Reagan administration, if you look at the numbers, economic growth during the 8 years of the Reagan administration was really not that impressive. It was not much better than the Carter administration.
Angela, so would you stimulate more now or hit the brakes? What would you do now?
You need to bail out the states now, because otherwise the states are going to be laying off teachers, social workers, police officers, and so forth. If the states aren't bailed out, you're going to have an increase in unemployment.
Thank you. Angela, that's a lot right there. Neil Ferguson, what do you say in response?
Well, first of all, Angela, I've never said that there shouldn't have been a stimulus bill. I've never said that. On the contrary, what I've said is that you needed short-term fiscal stimulus. That was unquestionably needed. But you had to have a medium-term plan to get back into equilibrium. You can't have a stimulus bill every year for the rest of time, because you end up in the fiscal death spiral. The fiscal arithmetic will get you if you go down that route. There's so much historical evidence of that it really shouldn't be controversial. I'm glad you raised the states, the position of the states, because there are a bunch of states now very close to the edge of what might be called a Greek style crisis. Illinois, New Jersey spring to mind. Of course, California is in dire straits. The problem is that if you simply say, as Angela just did, bail out the states, you know, write a $200 billion check to cover their deficits, you increase the probability that the problem simply moves to Washington and becomes a problem for the federal government. I can't emphasize enough the risks to the United States of a reassessment on the part of international lenders of its creditworthiness. That can happen, and this is really my key point, in a heartbeat. The U.S. relies very heavily on foreign lenders to finance its fiscal deficit.
But they've been doing that abundantly and abundantly very lately, right?
I've just come back from China, and the Chinese are interesting on this because for months they ceased, in fact, to buy treasuries. They were net sellers. The most recent month saw them buying again, and many people in Washington breathed a sigh of relief. Whew, the Chinese are back in the markets buying treasuries. But, you know, the only reason that happened was that they were selling euro-denominated bonds because they saw the credit risks spreading from the pigs, Portugal, Ireland, Greece, Spain, to the rest of Europe. All of this is about timing. At some point, if you pursue a fiscal policy as bad as that of Greece, which we currently are doing, you will eventually be called to account. And when I say eventually, I don't mean in 100 years. I mean within the next 4 years, maybe even within the next 2 years. And Angela, once the interest payments rise, once you're talking not about 3.2 or 3.5%, but 4.5 or 5.5%, you see an explosion erosion of expenditure on debt service that consumes a larger and larger share of total federal tax revenues. The lesson of history is that once you're spending more on interest on your debt than you're spending, say, on your military or you name it or anything else, then you are in that kind of imperial endgame that I've spent so much time writing about.
Gustavo, Boston, you're on the air with Neil Ferguson.
Well, I'm glad I came on right now because Neil is discussing a collapse of lending to the U.S. He doesn't take into account that Japan is at 170% of GDP, and people are lending to them hand over fist at 0% interest. The U.K. is at 50% debt to GDP. Mm-hmm. Germany's at 63% debt to GDP. India at 80% debt to GDP. Italy at
104%. So it's all relative, you say?
GDP. Canada, the great Canada,
with its tar sands,
fiscal powerhouse, is at 64% debt to GDP. The U.S., this nation that Mr. Ferguson is so worried about that no one will want to lend to, even though they're lending it hand over fist at 3% to us.
Gustavo, are you saying we're safe then? We don't need to worry? We're protected because others are in worse shape?
I'll tell you what I think. In Neil's worst-case scenario, his doom and fear-mongering, heck, at least we'll be there with all our friends. We'll get to go to England, you know, England, Japan, Germany. We'll
have a pity
all
party
ones with us.
Oh boy, great. I don't know which way to turn here, but Neil, what do you say to Gustavo's observation? Look, a lot of people are in a bad boat. Maybe ours is not so bad relatively. Maybe the money will continue to flow therefore.
When I hear people say, "Don't worry, look at Japan," I have to just step back in amazement. The Japanese have been in a 2-decade period of next to no growth.
Deflation.
And near deflation. Mm-hmm. If that's the scenario that makes you feel relaxed, if we are just going to turn Japanese, have an explosion of public debt, a very low growth, and teeter on the brink of deflation, which, by the way, we're quite close to. If you look at core inflation, it's practically zero right now. If that makes you feel good, then I'd like to smoke what you're smoking, because it doesn't make me feel good at all. The Japanese seem able to cope with very low growth, but they are a highly homogenous society. I think it's very questionable that the United States will be a stable country if it ends up with a trend growth rate closer to 1% than 4%. So this isn't an option for us. In any case, what the Japanese are showing right now is that there is an upper bound, even if you are a deflationary and relatively stable society. At some point pretty soon, I think that you will see Japan facing higher borrowing costs. So, you know, it's just a question, as I've said, of sequencing. If you rank countries by the degree of fiscal unsustainability, Japan is at the top. Mm-hmm. The U.S. is very near the top. It's up there with the so-called pigs, with Portugal, Ireland, Italy,
not as
Greece,
high.
And Spain. Well, it depends which metric you use, interestingly. I mean, if you, for example, look at a recent IMF study which asked what would countries have to do in terms of fiscal tightening to stabilize their debt-GDP ratios at 60% over a 20-year time frame, the United States is actually almost level pegging with Greece. The Bank for International Settlements did a study in which it looked at cyclically adjusted primary deficits. That's to say, you adjust for the fact that you're in a cycle, in a negative part of the cycle, and you deduct the amount you're spending on interest just to get the structural deficit. In that metric, the United States is significantly worse than Greece. In fact, the United States has the worst cyclically adjusted primary deficit of all developed countries. So I don't think there's any ground for the complacency that Angela is recommending. On the contrary, I think when you think this way, you should be very afraid indeed.
Is it a good thing that we've got this keyed up debate, let's say, between you and Krugman on this right now? You describe many empires kind of sleepwalking right into the teeth of their collapse. Is this debate a sign that that's not the American situation?
Well, I would hope so. There have been times when the debate has become, unfortunately, personalized. I won't say who was responsible for that, except that it wasn't me. This is a hugely important debate. This is a hugely important debate. The stakes are incredibly high. If we get this wrong, if we go down the route of hyper-Keynesianism and carry on borrowing until finally the Greek-style day of reckoning comes, then a great many people, ordinary Americans, what you call the small people, will suffer.
What the chairman of BP called the small people, and I've
right,
jestingly revived here.
I know.
To put it in your face, because it still seems to me like your prescription puts the pain there.
No, really, I can't emphasize enough that the critical thing here is to get the economy growing and creating jobs so that people at the lower end of the income scale are not facing welfare for years. And remember, the big nightmare scenario at the moment is that the United States is developing European symptoms, which means that the unemployment that we see in the U.S. in this crisis is much longer term than anything we've seen in previous decades.
Yeah.
It's a very worrying sign when you get young people trapped in welfare for years on end because they become unemployable. That's one of the big differences, I think, between me and Paul Krugman, that ultimately Paul would really like to see the United States become more like a West European country. And my argument is that if you go down that route, and of course I've lived most of my life in Western Europe, there are some pretty ugly unintended consequences precisely for people at the lower end of the income scale. I come from Glasgow. You know, this is a post-industrial rust belt city. Most people of my generation who didn't get a good education ended up spending their lives on welfare or in jail. That is not an outlook which I would recommend for any relatively impoverished country. Or rather part of the United States. This is a really important argument. It's not about, you know, tax breaks for the rich. This argument is about jobs for the relatively poor. If we get this wrong, we'll end up with the kind of unemployment that's become normal in Spain. You know, the Spaniards think nothing of 20% unemployment. Is that what we want?
Well, let's go to a place where they know unemployment, Michigan, St. John's, Michigan. Mike, you're on the air with Neil Ferguson.
Yeah, hi, Tom and Neil. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome.
I agree that we really need to get out of our deficit situation, and I think there are some good ways to do it. I think that we need to reevaluate our tax structure that gives big business tax credits to take jobs out of this country. We need to do just the opposite, to give big businesses tax credits to create jobs in this country. And I think there are other ways to do this also that would also enhance this is we spend more money on military spending than the rest of the world combined, so I think we need to get that in line by just cutting a lot of that out.
Mike, I'm glad to hear from you there in St. John's, Michigan. We'll pick it up. Neil, how about it? End any tax advantages for going offshore, maybe even penalize offshore factories? What about cutting military spending? What's the lesson of history there?
Great to hear from you, Mike, and it was nice to go from my Glaswegian roots to Michigan, which is in many ways suffering the way the west of Scotland did in the 1970s. There needs to be a level playing field. It's crazy to incentivize businesses to export jobs. What we need is tax neutrality, and I agree with you completely. We need to be encouraging businesses to hire people in the United States, and that can mean, for example, reform of corporate tax. Corporate tax in the United States is among the it's one of the highest in terms of the rate of any developed country, and that seems to me something that a radical fiscal reform would look at. On the military budget, I think you might get what you wish for. It's pretty much baked into the cake that the military budget will come down because it's one of the few parts of federal expenditure that's defined as discretionary. And now, as interest payments rise, it's almost inevitable that we'll see the military budget squeeze. And that brings us back to this whole imperial argument. Whether you like it or not, the United States has pretty massive military overseas commitments, not least in Afghanistan and Iraq. One of, it seems to me, the inevitable consequences of this fiscal crisis is that resources available for state building in those countries will diminish. And we are looking, I think, ultimately over the next 5 or 10 years to the end of American strategic primacy in the greater Middle East. That's going to be one of the things that historians look back on the Obama administration and talk about, I suspect. The way in which a domestically driven fiscal crisis ultimately pushed the United States into a position of really much greater strategic weakness than Americans are used to.
Obama administration, or maybe, again, George W. Bush administration. Certainly, I can imagine the beer budget for General McChrystal hanging out with Rolling Stone coming down radically in the next few weeks. Yeah, we'll talk about that tomorrow.
General McChrystal will be otherwise engaged by the end of today.
We will get to that shortly. Lee in Auburn, Alabama. Lee, you're on with Neil Ferguson.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Neil. Thank you very much. I like what you're saying, Neil. I am my husband and I are small business owners, barely any income, no employees. I know you talk about the macro, but in the micro, what can I do? What do I have control over in this massive, you know, cluster F that I see going on?
Well, Lee, can I ask you what kind of a business you and your husband run?
My husband and I own the basically the only you know, gourmet wine and beer shop in our little tiny town, and I still teach at a proprietary school to make ends meet. You know, we have no health insurance, we have no employees, no time off.
Do you have any business?
I am the little guy. Mm-hmm. Oh, we have lots of business. We have lots of business. The business plan said, in a depression, people drink, and boy, did they back me up on that.
Lee, our time is short. Neil, what do you say to our struggling small business person?
Well, I'm relieved to hear that people in Alabama are coping the way people throughout history have coped with depression by buying more beer. I'd be interested to know, Lee, how much you rely on the banks for finance of your business.
I think Lee is gone, unfortunately.
Well, then let me follow that up by saying, because that's crucial. You know, Tom, if you're running a small business like that, you're very heavily reliant, by and large, on credit. And it's been hard for small businesses to keep rolling over their debts if they're in that kind of a sector of the economy. It's crucial to bear in mind in all these discussions that we have. For a small business, the most worrying things are, number one, can you roll over your borrowings? Number two, are you going to get clobbered with higher taxes in the next year or so? And I think for anybody like Lee, the big worry must be that fiscal policies and monetary policies that have been about too big to fail banks and fiscal stimulus, these imply tougher times ahead for small business. And as long as that's the case, they don't hire employees.
Neil, it can sound as though you're warning of end of empire, but it can sound in your remarks today, we've just got a minute left, that you see the era of American ascendancy as already over.
Well, I do think that it's coming to an end, though it's not completely irreversible. If we got this right over the next few years, if we achieved the kind of fiscal reforms I'm talking about, particularly of entitlements, and got the U.S. economy back onto a higher growth path, then it might not all be over. But after 2 weeks in China, I have to say, with the policies we're currently pursuing, the moment is not too far away when China is not only the biggest manufacturer in the world, but the biggest economy in the world. That's coming soon.
Neil Ferguson, his new book is High Financier, The Lives and Time of Sigmund Warburg, author of Empire, of Colossus, of The Ascent of Money, professor at Harvard University, senior research fellow at Jesus College, Oxford University. Neil Ferguson, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Julie Jupp, Sam Gale Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Marika Spence, and John Wibby, with help from Britt Hansen and Evelyn Radigan. Our senior producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.